Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us here at KMXT 100.1 FM for another episode of Talk of the Rock. I'm your host today, Dylan Simard, and joining me are Matt Vandale, the Shunack Tribe. I'm sorry, I'm losing the word. Your job title changed since the last time we did an episode on invasive species.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, Natural Resources Director.
Natural Resources Director. And Blythe Brown, the Programs Coordinator and District Manager for Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District. How are the two of you doing today?
Doing good.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having us back on.
I'm always happy to talk about invasive species. Not happy about them, but happy to talk about them. So it is Invasive Species Week. I guess let's catch people up who might not have heard the last time that we had the discussion. What are invasive species and why are they not a good thing?
I'll read you the Presidential Executive Order 13112. Invasive species, they're alien species whose introduction does or is likely to cause economic or environmental harm or harm to human health. So the key is the harm that they do to our habitats and environment, agricultural areas, pretty much anything.
So can you give me some examples of some of the different varieties of invasive species that we have here on Kodiak?
Well, Matt will be talking about the crayfish, or the crawdads, or crawfish, however you want to pronounce it. Orange hawkweed is our kind of poster child of Kodiak, with very many infestations are in Kodiak itself, and it is escaping out of Kodiak. It's also in Nusinke and Port Lions and escaping out of both of those communities, too. Other species include, there's some invasive grasses. Reed canary grass impacts aquatic habitats and salmon habitat. We've got Bohemian knotweed is a kind of, it's a brush style life cycle. It looks like a big bush when it's alive, but it is a perennial and it grows up every year and dies back every year. It can impact stream channels, stream banks. We have a few infestations of that species in residential sites. It has not escaped out into the wild yet. We'd like to prevent its escape. We've got quite a list of other invasive species. Oxeye daisy, we had one Himalayan blackberry infestation here in Kodiak.
Wow.
To my knowledge, it is gone, and I have not seen another one. That's not to say that there are not others hiding someplace in somebody's yard.
Well, that's really good. I mean, frankly, it's rare that you hear of an invasive species group actually being eliminated.
That's the whole idea behind early detection, rapid response.
Right.
I get our grant funding that we receive to deal with these plants. The key is to detect them early and respond quickly. If you do that, like with the Himalayan blackberry that we did find and was removed, now it's gone. And it was not able to establish a population.
Right.
And so others, white sweet clover, we had one infestation eradicated. So we no longer have white sweet clover that we know of. So if anybody knows it, please report it. And there's a few others that we've done that to also. And we have a few other species that we only have a few infestations that we're still dealing with, but working on them.
Right. So we're going to come back to invasive plant species, but Matt, I was hoping to talk to you about the changing rules and regulations in regards to signal crayfish. To my understanding, it used to be that not all that long ago, it used to be just about anybody could throw on a wetsuit, or I guess get extremely cold, and go and get some signal crayfish out of the buskin. But to my understanding, that is no longer the case, and not just anybody can go and harvest crayfish. What changed?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Basically what happened is recently new regulations were adopted by Fish and Game, and there is a completely new classification system that they just adopted. and it's called banned invasive species. And so there's now a list of species that are officially categorized as banned invasive species within the state of Alaska, of which signal crayfish are one of them. And along with these new regulations, it also prohibits the capture, transport, removal, anything of that, of these banned invasive species. And so that's created some unique challenges for us here in Kodiak, because very fortunately, within Alaska, the only place with signal crayfish in the entire state of Alaska is within the Buskin watershed. And because they've been there for probably about the last two decades, from the best that we can tell. So we've, in some respects, moved past that early detection, rapid response phase, which is, you know, that's the critical golden hour with invasive species management and eradication, is early detection, rapid response. That being said, there are areas of the Buskin watershed which signal crayfish probably have not been able to invade or colonize yet. And so we are in some areas still within that early detection, rapid response. And so if we can kind of basically close off those areas through monitoring, then we can work to contain the crayfish to where they're at right now. And within those areas of where they're at right now, really ramp up our eradication efforts to try to remove as many as possible. And what we've done in the past was enlist the help of the public, because we can't do this by ourselves. It's frankly not financially responsible nor sustainable just to keep pouring money from federal grants at this. We really need to enlist and empower the public to be able to help us, to be a force multiplier for us. But now, because of these new regulations, we've lost a lot of that ability. And that's something that we've got some workarounds at the present, but we're hoping on coming up with a more permanent solution in the future. And it sounds like the folks in Juneau are considering ideas about having different categories within these banned invasive species, so that perhaps signal crayfish might have kind of a different classification within those banned list, so that the public would have a little bit more ability to work with us in the years to come in eradication efforts and removing them.
So I certainly would imagine that the stress on any sort of natural population of having several of your members being taken up by giants in wetsuits would be a very effective tool for managing the overall population of mm-hmm. the signal crayfish. Is there a risk that their population growth might precipitate their ability to enter other waterways for the lack of having the members of the public going in there and just gobbling them up?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of my biggest concerns, actually. And one of the we're trying to focus on key areas within the Buskin Lake itself, of not only highest crayfish densities that we're finding, but also those are areas near the outlet itself. And our thought is that if we remove more from these key kind of critical habitat areas, there's going to be less of an incentive on the remaining crayfish to feel like they need to move around. Because one of the biggest competitors to crayfish or other crayfish. And it's a very, very important and delicate balancing act, because also if we are only removing the large adults, they're highly cannibalistic to younger crayfish. And there have been numerous studies in other parts of the world where if you're only removing the large adults, you're actually potentially increasing the probability of your crayfish population increasing, because the juveniles are going to have a better chance of survival. And that's why we need to have a very collective approach to this and have multiple tools in the toolbox. And granted, one of our biggest tools was having the public involvement, but we're going to, you know, make sure that we're balancing out all of the other elements, from electrofishing so we get the smallest crayfish that we can catch, to, you know, the public involvement and people in waders and hip boots and whatnot. They're kind of getting those mid-range juvenile crayfish versus the folks that are out diving that are getting the big adults. And so if we're able to have a complete spectrum there, then we're going to make sure that we have pressure exerted on every single life stage in the crayfish life cycle.
Okay. So with that being said, what are sort of your tools in the toolbox right now? Are there any signal crayfish that are getting taken out of the water, or
There are. We do have our research permit from Fish and Game so that we're able to continue with the federal grants that we have been received. And something that I'm very excited about is that within this permit, the Fish and Game gave us, they gave us a special dispensation to sign people on as volunteers to help us catch. And could you pass this over to Dylan for me? And so what I've just handed to our host is the official, unofficial Shunack crayfish hunting license.
What an honor.
And so you are now live and on air our newest crayfish fishing volunteer, if you would like.
I would love to. And you know, this is funny. I'm actually vegan, but I will make an exception for the Signal crayfish because eating Signal crayfish is good for the world.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
I'll tell you what, you don't have to eat them. You can catch the little ones that are too small to eat.
I'm definitely eating. I'm not. You think I'm going to jump in the water and not eat a Signal crayfish? Come on.
And so what folks could do is sign on as a volunteer with Shunack, and as long as either myself or my tribal biologist, Daniel Smith, are actually out there with you when you're catching crayfish, you can assist us with our efforts. And so that's something that we're excited about.
Oh, hang on. We're getting a little photo opportunity here. Let me hold up the card. Thank you so much. Well, I'm very excited for this. And this is not going to be the only one of these events.
Correct. Yeah. Our first planned official event is July 1st. And we're hoping to have an actual crayfish boil out there at the Buskin. Because another thing Fish and Game did for us is they said as long as you cook them out there on site, you can actually have community crayfish boils. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be a great way to help us get a lot of crayfish out. By that time, we're going to be doing the mark recapture experiment too. And so we'll have a certain number of crayfish that are marked with a little colored tag in their abdomen. And so we can figure out how many crayfish overall we catch and then tabulate how many of the marked ones that we caught and then be able to start coming up with a population estimate. And so this is a great way to dramatically increase our population size that we're removing from whom we can collect data, but also start getting some life history, some age class, recruitment, survival, things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be on July 1st, which is a Friday, and we picked a Friday because there are times when a lot of the Coast Guard Air Station has that day off, and we would love to get a little competition going between the flight mechs and the swimmers and us to see who can catch the most crayfish. So we're really looking forward to that. Another one's coming up on August 6th, which is actually the official Scandinavian Crayfish Day. And since Scandinavians, you know, have a very strong tradition of crayfishing and partying with crayfish, we picked the 6th of August for that. So those are our two officially planned events.
So I'm sure it doesn't replace the loss of having just an open crayfish season, mm-hmm. but I have no doubt that it will be an excellent affair for raising the public awareness and at least making sure that folks are eating some of the crayfish.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I want to ask you as well, do you think that you're going to be able to reinstate it, to get things back to how they were? Will people be able to go and crayfish liberally again? Or
I think that we're actually going to have something better than we had before. I don't know if it's going to be exactly how we had before, but I think that having an extra step, you know, for instance, you know, you needed to have a sport fishing license before, and I think that's really important to keep that, mm-hmm. Just so that there's an extra additional point of contact of understanding the severity of this issue, of the damage that crayfish can have and already are having. And I think that increasing all this public knowledge of this is actually ultimately going to help all of our goals of dealing with this invasive species and protecting our salmon too, whereas before people may not have really been aware of what they can do to help this situation, and now with, you know, all this coverage about it, they might feel more aware or empowered and excited to come and help.
That it's not hopeless, and that crayfish are also delicious.
Yes, exactly. And I still, you know, we talked last year, and I was thinking, you know, I think we might be able to have an impact on this population. I'm not really sure. It's just biologist intuition, but I think we are. I'm even more sure now that we're going to have that ability to start suppressing or depressing this population of crayfish. I really do. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's going to take continued public involvement.
I think the banned invasive species list and the new regulations and the strategy that Matt's saying, one thing we do need to remember is I think all this education is going to help educate the public on the damage that they can do. But we also have to remember that we need to prevent their transfer to other waters. And sometimes when you start saying, oh, they're so delicious, people are tempted to transfer them to other waters. Oh, they're killing mm-hmm. them in the buskin. Let's go put them over here so they don't kill them. But that's why the banned list was created, to prevent them from moving anywhere. Mm-hmm. They don't want them to be moving in your vehicle alive at all. So that's why you need to cook them on site. So these are just some of the issues that you do need to think about, and we need to think about as we're dealing with invasive species.
Right. Well, that is a very good point, I just hope it gets resolved in a way where that population does get ultimately eliminated, and hopefully by way of people turning them into delicious food.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you as well, let's transfer this conversation here going in the direction of invasive plants. Blythe, how do invasive plants impact other native fauna or flora? Whoops.
Well, they do impact fauna too.
Right.
So flora and fauna. It all depends on which species you're talking about. In the booklets that we've given away in the past to the public and some of the brochures that are available is the classic picture of orange hawkweed taking over the wildflower meadows on Camp Island in the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. Last year we found a patch of oxeye daisy up on top of Pillar Mountain. So the whole top of Pillar Mountain could become oxeye daisy and orange hawkweed, and they displace the native plants. So all the pollinators that would normally be up there on the geraniums and bog orchids and all those other awesome native plants, those pollinators wouldn't have access to their natural foods. What else was your question?
What sort of impact do they have on the... We have had a listener question. I have been asked to ask you for comment about the invasive pigeon problem in Kodiak.
I'd rather talk about the starlings. The pigeons are a problem. But mostly to my observation, they're a problem in the city. Matt, are you familiar with the pigeons any more than I am?
I am really not, but that also kind of brings up an interesting point about rats too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Pigeons are sometimes called rats on wings.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So the bird issue, though, itself, like the starlings, there's been five starlings observed overwintering in Kodiak. So far, to my knowledge, they have never been observed nesting in Kodiak or reproducing in Kodiak, but they have visited. And the damage they would do would be replacing cavity nesters. Starlings nest in holes, and so do the chickadees and the nuthatches and some other species and woodpeckers. So the starlings would definitely displace our native birds. Pigeons cause a problem when they're being fed.
Mm-hmm.
They would attract more rats to those areas.
Right. And can you speak broadly about the damage of rats as well?
Oh, my.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, you've probably heard about issues out of the Aleutian Islands, the Aleutian
right.
chain. And
a running joke in the radio station has been about how we want to direct a movie where people get marooned on a fishing boat and find themselves on an island swarming with rats.
Yeah.
Nobody copy that. That is that we're trademarking
yeah.
that right now. But no, it's I remember, because Terry was telling me about that, where they they have these islands that are just
just devastated, absolutely devastated by rats.
Yeah, it's
rats will eat the seabird eggs and young. So the seabird colonies on the islands will be as Matt says, devastated by rats.
Well, I guess let's hope for now that those problems are contained. Certainly, it is good that we're getting information out about it. Mm-hmm. Let's turn it back to the topic of the invasive plants. I think you mentioned, and I remember I did a story just about a year ago on the how plants like orange hawkweed have their own natural pesticide that they use to sterilize or annihilate their competition. Can you tell me a little bit about the effect of some of these non-native plants on fauna?
On other plants, the orange hawkweed has what they call an allelopathic property, where they actually have a toxic chemical in them that will not let the other plants germinate where they are. So that's how they displace a lot of the natives, but with actual chemical property. And I didn't write it down, so I can't remember the name now. It could be a trivia game name. There is a name also for the fact that the seeds of orange hawkweed are viable without pollination. So as soon as they open up, they produce more plants. So.
And of course, this is pretty nasty. I can only imagine for their long-term propagation. It's been a while since I've had so many listener questions on a Talk of the Rock. Someone on the line is asking a question on the history of what caused the...
Has the history of the beginning of the pigeon problem.
Oh, that's so fascinating.
If you want to talk to them, they're on hold.
Sure.
Okay.
Hello, is this Charlie Davidson?
It is.
Hi, Charlie. You mentioned that you had some information on the history of what caused the pigeon problem.
That's correct. And this is what I know. And as far as I know, it's an absolute true story because it's from the source. A gentleman used to live here, or maybe still is for all I know, felt a loyalty to the pigeons because during World War II, some carrier pigeons had saved his uncle, possibly, or something. Anyway, he was a soldier. He was supposedly a fighter pilot. And so he fed those pigeons, and you would see him at times walking from Walmart with a 25-pound pack of pigeon feed. And he'd feed these pigeons because of his feeling of, you know, how they operated during World War II. And I don't know, like I say, I don't know. I know he grew old by putting those 25-pound packs of seed and corn and chopped, you know, other seeds on his back walking from Walmart to his home.
Right.
But that's what I know. And I'll relate another story. I remember that one time when I was at work as a longshoreman, I was over by the office and one of these pigeons was flying around, and I swear an eagle came down and got this pigeon while it was flying in the air.
Wow.
And I was standing about literally 25 feet from him or less. So anyway, that's my story about the pigeon, and it's true because I saw it with my own eyes.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Charlie. We really appreciate it. And take care.
Charlie brings up a good point in a lot of these invasive species are brought in accidentally by well-meaning people.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know the damage they're going to do after they bring them in. Orange hawkweed was brought in the mid-60s by Kodiak gardeners. They wanted something pretty to plant in their garden that would still be growing when they came back from fishing.
And it's still growing.
That's, yes.
So... let's get into what people can do right now to combat this issue, particular to invasive plants. I know that there's an issue of people going out hiking in their boots transplanting them. Can you tell us a little bit about that and preventative measures that folks can take to make sure that that doesn't happen?
They can clean their boots before they go out. With this, all these push right now to go out onto our trails. I guess there's the altitude challenge.
Right. Adjust your altitude.
Adjust your altitude. I noticed the 4-H kids are.
Has that already begun? I got to get out there.
The 4-H kids are now starting a hiking group. And I think the Audubon group had 30 hikers on their trail the other day.
Wow.
So each and every one of those hikers and the dogs they bring with them can track seeds out. So if you have orange hawkweed in your yard, and if you can't get rid of it or if you don't want to get rid of it, at least keep it from blooming, because every single flower will be producing hundreds of seeds that will track on your boots, in the mud, on your dogs, and then it will track on to the trails. If it does get out onto the trails, we would like to hear about it, so we can do that early detection rapid response and enlist the help of the public. You know, Matt wants to enlist the help of the public with out there in the buskin. We would like to enlist every single one of those hikers on our trails. If you see orange hawkweed on a trail outside of the main concentration areas in Kodiak, tell us and tell the landowner. The landowners need to become responsible too.
Go ahead.
Oh yeah, I just say one of the big things is just get informed, get involved. AlaskaInvasives.org is a very good website to check out. Next week is Alaska Invasive Species Awareness Week. The Alaska Invasive Species Partnership is going to be putting out stuff on Facebook throughout the week about local events and, you know, information, and a very good resource. Our local borough, thank you very much, local borough. They're going to be issuing a proclamation at their regular meeting next week, declaring that it's also Invasive Species Awareness Week for the Kodiak Island Borough and the Kodiak Archipelago. So we've got a lot of good resources available. So yeah, get informed, get involved, and we definitely would appreciate your help.
We're down to our last 2 minutes here. I want to ask you, Matt, a question that I asked you the last time that you were on, down to our last minute. Is it hopeless? Do you believe that we can do something about this, and that people, that it's not just a foregone conclusion that these species are going to continue to flourish here?
Oh, it's absolutely not hopeless. I mean, we have so many things going for us. First and foremost, just the Kodiak community and how involved and plugged into the outdoors and just the strength of our community. And a lot of places don't have that going for them, but we do. So we absolutely can have a positive impact, and every single person can have that positive impact. And then you think about, you know, we get several hundred people out there to help us catch crayfish, just how much of an impact that would have in helping our salmon. So it's going to be a lot of work, but we can do it.
And we can still prevent introduction of new species.
Well, I wish you both the best of luck in your work to contain the invasive species problem. This has been another episode of KMXT 100.1 FM's Talk of the Rock. I've been your host today, Dylan Smart, and joining me were Matt Vandale, the Natural Resources Director for the Shunack Tribe, and Blythe Brown, the Programs Coordinator and District Manager for Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you.